Hub tonight, and I'm delighted to be chairing this event. The event is predicated on the question which I think has troubled many of us over the last year, which is whether or not the COVID pandemic has exposed and deepened inequalities, or whether it's opened up some cracks in which we might be able to see change. So from the start of the pandemic, Black and brown communities were disproportionately affected, and women have borne the brunt in terms of gender violence, caring responsibilities, and economic hardship. Governments have often taken responses and are creating a global vaccine apartheid, while the world's billionaires accumulate more riches. So the world's 2,365 billionaires increased their wealth by $4 trillion, or 54%, during the first year of the pandemic. And while they were getting richer, they were also getting vaccinated. As of the 21st of July this year, 50.15% of people in high-income countries have been vaccinated against COVID, versus only 1.32% of people in low-income countries. This event brings together researchers from three different GCRF hubs to discuss whether the pandemic is just business as usual, or whether it can be used as a disruption to the system, exposing cracks that can be exploited to confront power and inequality. And before we start, I'd like to give you a relatively full introduction to the three hubs before I turn to our speakers. So first off, the Arise Hub. The Arise Hub aims at strengthening accountability mechanisms for improving equitable health and well-being for people living and working in informal urban spaces. Just over half the world's population live in cities, and one in three of these people live in informal urban settlements, also known as slums. These areas face challenges, including rapid social, economic, and demographic transitions, health risks and vulnerabilities, fluid governance, often characterized by long-standing neglect from the state, and residents' limited voice and power. Cities illustrate the world's starkest disparities in income, health, and well-being. The Arise Hub aims to catalyze change in approaches to enhancing accountability and improving the health and well-being of poor, marginalized people in informal urban settlements. Using participatory approaches, the hub works with people in these settlements to support them to collect, analyze, and communicate their experiences and build alliances for enhanced governance. The hub has partners in Kenya, Bangladesh, India, and Sierra Leone, and includes the international network Slum and Shack Dwellers International. In their recent publications, Arise community researchers have drawn attention to life in urban slums amid the pandemic, shared how to support communities during the pandemic, and highlighted the continued exclusion of informal settlement residents in COVID responses. There's a lot more information about the Arise Hub on its website, and I hope that Becca or Evelyn will share their websites. In fact, they may have already done so in the chat for all three of these hubs. And let me tell you something about MyDEC. The MyDEC Hub unpacks the complex and multidimensional relationships between migration and inequality in the context of the Global South. MyDEC aims to transform understanding of the relationship between migration and inequality by decentering the production of knowledge about migration and its consequences away from the global north and towards those countries where most migration takes place. The overarching vision of the hub is to disrupt dominant assumptions about the reasons why people move and the consequences of migration, to deepen knowledge and understanding of the relationships between South-South migration, inequality, and delivery of the Sustainable Development Goals, explore the impact and effectiveness of interventions designed to reduce inequalities associated with South-South migration, build research capacity, bring new and existing knowledge and expertise into contact with local, national, and international organizations, and through this to influence policy processes, to challenge dominant narratives, and ultimately to improve the lives of migrants, their families, and the communities of which they're a part. And I would encourage you to watch MyDEC's recently launched animation, available in six languages on their website, The Story of Migration, which explains why South-South migration is important and what MyDEC is trying to do. And last but not least, the Gender Justice and Security Hub, of which I'm a part. This hub seeks to advance gender justice and inclusive peace in conflict-affected societies. Conflict and gender-based violence have devastating long-term consequences on individuals, families, and communities. They severely hamper the successful delivery of development goals internationally. By bringing researchers together from multiple disciplines and practices, the hub seeks to advance the delivery of Sustainable Development Goal 5 on gender equality, 16 on peace, justice, and strong institutions, and the implementation of the Women, Peace and Security agenda by developing an evidence base around gender justice and inclusive security, particularly in conflict-affected societies. Some recent publications worth seeking out have looked at the gendered impacts of internally displaced persons in Jaffna in Sri Lanka, the impacts of the Syrian civil war on persons of diverse sexual orientations, gender identities, excuse me, and expressions, and sex characteristics in Syria, Lebanon, and Turkey, and also a comprehensive overview of gender equality in Colombia as part of a new report to be launched on the Hub's Focus on Colombia Day. Now, the work of all three hubs is under threat due to the catastrophic and unnecessary UK cuts to overseas development aid. And we gather tonight in solidarity and in the knowledge that these critically important projects and the enormous number of partnerships and the amount of work that they build on are in the middle of a struggle to survive long enough to achieve their goals. Let me turn now to our speakers, who I'm delighted to have with us. We have speakers from all three of the hubs tonight to address these questions. And they've all been asked to speak for 6 or 7 minutes on the following questions. To what extent is COVID business as usual, exacerbating inequalities and privileging those with power? Has COVID opened up cracks or exposed weaknesses in systems of power, which have the potential to lead to transformation? What needs to be done to achieve transformation and who needs to do it? And what have been the most innovative and transformative responses to COVID and the inequalities that it has generated and deepened, which you have seen or participated in? These questions were supposed merely to be a provocation to the speakers, so they won't. They may be answering each of them in turn, but they may not. And I will ask the speakers to speak first, Dr. Sarika Garamella from the Arise Hub, followed by Josefina Hikiri from the Gender Justice and Security Hub, followed by Dr. Faisal Garba from the MIDEC Hub. And we're hoping, although I don't know yet, whether Dr. Anita Gimiri has been able to join us. So we may, Heaven Calling may be speaking on behalf of the MIDEC Hub instead. So without further ado, let me introduce our first speaker tonight, Dr. Sarika Garamella from the Arise Hub, who's joining us tonight from India. Dr. Garamella is a senior research fellow at the George Institute for Global Health in India and holds a PhD in public health, gender and work. She works on gender, women, work and political economy, gendered health systems and accountability, feminist theory and practice, and the ethics of research practice. Dr. Garamella, over to you.
Hello. I hope you can hear me. Hello?
Hello, yes, we can hear you.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Sorry about that. Yes, thank you for giving this opportunity to essentially share, I think in some ways, what has been a very, there's been some sort of a collective connection in terms of what COVID has meant across the world. And while the connections are there and people, there's certainly a lot of worry, goodwill, support, people trying to support each other across countries, across, you know, even in Arise Hub, we've been trying to support each other across countries, etc. and so on. But I think I will start with the first question that you, we've asked to comment on, which is COVID business as usual? And meaning, is it exacerbating inequalities and privileging those with power? From my own experience, I think in our work in India, I would say yes, and a certain yes. But whether it has exacerbated inequalities, yes. But I think what it has also done is maybe shown a mirror to the world and to ourselves as to how entrenched these inequalities are in all of our societies. And this is nothing to do with whether we are from low middle income countries or high income countries. I think the poor people across the world have struggled for decades, actually. And I think what COVID has done is basically shown it to us. I do believe it's made a lot of people uncomfortable because of what we'd like to see. So, but what is it about, what are the inequalities that have been exacerbated? Exacerbation of inequalities has occurred through complete cessation of livelihoods among the poor, which also means in essentially in real daily lives that people who worked up to 16, 18 hours a day to put food on the table, with no cushions of either money or food or places to stay, ended up in a position where they had no work and they had no food. And it is astonishing that governments across the world did not seem to think that this reality existed among the more sort of the more glittering development achievements, etc. and so on. So I think that is one of the things. I think one of the other things that it has shown us is that the world of global health and public health, the evidence that is used there and the policies and recommendations suggested to contain the infectious diseases flu have not taken into account the poor across the world at all. And this remains an issue. This is a huge issue because the proportion of poor are very high, especially in my country, in India. So, that is an issue. So I think one of the things which maybe I will talk a little bit later is how the global health community and the public health communities need to start thinking more closely as to how they define their evidence and what evidence is, much going beyond the biomedical or the clinical worlds. Because ultimately the recommendations are practiced on people and there are different implications by class, by gender, by caste in our country and by many other kinds of divisions that we see across the world. So that's one of the things. I think to that extent for me, what the COVID has done since last year is that it's almost like the inverse care law, The most marginal who need to access protective measures, testing, and all of those things are the ones who get it the least. And this is happening within a context where for decades they have been living where there is huge basic needs deficit. So the poor communities actually live within a deficit ecosystem, whether it is cash flow, whether it is jobs, whether it is healthcare access, whether it is social security access. These are some of the things, there are many others. So you find that you have COVID coming and then we can't even say it's a triple whammy or a double whammy. It's too many whammies together to say. So that's one of the things. Particularly around gender, I can only talk mainly about women because the focus of much of our work is around women. So I would request people to forgive me if I'm not able to talk about others. So that is the thing. I think some of the most difficult things to see as we living through the pandemic is the impact of policing on poor women. So when in India we had the lockdown announced and the Disaster Management Act was, it was notified and so it gives the state a lot of powers to do what they need to do to help the situation. But largely this has been seen as a law and order issue. So the othering continues even in the responses to COVID. So you want to keep people away, the poor away, because you don't want them to infect the dominant classes and the castes. And so the corralling of the poor through the lockdown, what did it mean for women? A simple example we can tell you is, we consistently heard, particularly the TGI group in the Arise Hub, we work with waste-picking communities. So they told was the impact on menstrual management for them. They were not able to buy pads. They were not, even if they had some, there was no privacy for them to dispose it because they don't have toilets. They have to use communal toilets. Communal toilet use was not allowed. It's a kind of indignity. I don't think many of the dominant class and caste women even begin to understand what this means for them. So that is one of the things we heard a lot about, how difficult it was for them to manage their menstrual cycles with dignity. That was an issue. The other thing was obviously, and this has been written extensively since last year, is the, it's almost like with every month, the extension of care work that women are doing, whether it is within the family, in the communities, for the state, for the country, the margins have been just, you know, the boundaries have been just moving and increasing the load of the overburden care. I'm sure other speakers would possibly talk a little bit more, so I won't go into that. But what one of the most damaging things that happened was that historically in the last sort of 4 or 5 decades of, you know, feminist organizing, development organizing, all the various things that have happened was of empowering women, that the term that has been used, I'm a little uncomfortable with that term, empowering women to be able to work and earn money. It has been one of the biggest sort of driving pathways of moving development, moving women's rights along. But what happened to the women waste pickers that we're working with is the ability to collect waste, which is always, even during normal times, decided by different governing social governance groups, whether it's the police, whether it is the people from the government, whether it is people who live in different, in the upper class or dominant class societies, they decide where the women can go and what they can collect. What happened during COVID is since last year, this has become highly restricted. So just to give you an example, on an average, a woman waste picker gets up at 3 a.m. and walks till about 1 p.m. to be able to collect enough waste to earn, to sell it to the local scrap dealer, to earn enough money to put food on the table for that day for her family. And so this has become highly restricted, and the loss of dignity was extremely difficult for the women, because despite all the difficulties, they were earning some money and there was a certain sense of, we're doing our own thing, we're feeding ourselves, we're not dependent on others. But I think loss of dignity is a huge issue that we've seen among the poor. And then, so this is significant decreases in income for the women. And then the children are home, so they need to be fed more because they're not going to school. So the midday meal scheme, which used to deliver one meal a day for the kids, now has to be given when you have a shorter pie of money to feed your own family. Then if we look at healthcare access, it was, I know that there were write-ups in a lot of the international newspapers about how women were not able to go to institutions for deliveries and died because of it, because there was no safe delivery and so on. Within our own groups that we're working with, we have seen an increase in home deliveries. They're delivering the babies themselves because they can't go. That is one of the issues. So even something basic as antenatal care for women and institutionalized delivery, which has been a huge focus of the Indian public health system for the poor in the last few decades, simply fell apart. And I think that's a very worrying sign when we don't anticipate what could happen and what this means for the poor women, who are the ones who may use the public health system. So I think that is something to think. So in a way, how to, just to sort of stop at this question is that, I think if we just look at women, I think the dominant class women, it was a public health issue. You could manage to cocoon yourself in your homes. You could work from home. You were still earning money. You managed to do, but for the poor, it was mainly a law and order issue and complete cessation of livelihood opportunities for many months. So I think it was one of the, so this is broadly what I felt was about COVID. The other one was, has COVID opened up cracks or exposed weakness?
Dr. Garamella, I think we should, if I can, let me move on to Josephine, and we're going to come back to a lot of these issues in the general discussion.
Thank you so much
for those opening remarks. Incredibly important, and particularly this point about dignity, that for all that's been lost in the last 18 months, enormous amounts of dignity has been lost in ways that are often not seen. So thank you very, very much for those opening remarks. I look forward to coming back to you. Let me move now to Dr. Josephine Ahikiri, who is my colleague on the Gender Justice and Security Hub. Professor Ahikiri is the principal of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences and the former Dean of the School of Women and Gender Studies at Makerere University in Uganda. She's a member for the Council for Development of Social Research in Africa, and her research interests are gender and politics, feminist theory, livelihoods, and cultural studies. Josephine, over to you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon. For some people, good night. I'm also very happy to be in this space. And responding to these questions around exposing the cracks, COVID-19 and global inequality, I think just like the previous speaker, it is pretty much the same. And what I'm going to do is to sort of go beyond the global inequality conversation, which is really critical. Definitely, you know, the vaccine apartheid, the kind of frameworks that are crafted without the, you know, experience of the other, maybe largely the global south. All these are questions. And that then also tells us about what is happening in the national context. What does that mean in the national context? And I'm going to use the context of Uganda. So what does the COVID-19 actually mean? What are the cracks? And I'm saying actually that we could look at this as a nest that has opened. The nest has opened. And what do we do with it? What are the contents of this nest? How do we handle it? And I think it's important also to say who will handle these contents of the nest. What does the COVID-19 pandemic look like in Uganda? I see it as one of those, what you'd say, offshoots of the fallacy of neoliberalism and the fact that all along the market was supposed to determine everything. And now we see that actually we have to see the centrality of the state and the way in which it must actually respond to situations that affect citizens. So what has happened is that actually we have two pandemics in Uganda. There's the pandemic for the rich, the wealthy, and there's the pandemic for the poor. What does the pandemic for the wealthy look like? that's what, for example, what Sureka has mentioned, stay at home, get to work if you can, get permits to drive your cars around, and then finally, pay hefty hospital bills. What has happened in Uganda right now is a kind of what you'd call maybe genocide. What is happening in hospitals is the hefty bills, about $30,000 for a 2-week hospitalization. And we are experiencing people in the wealthy class whose, you know, there's this thing about the hospital cannot release the body, unfortunately, before these bills are paid. And what does that tell us is that there is a sort of deficiency in the healthcare system, in the health system at large. And so what previously used to happen is that the wealthy would go to private hospitals, they would be flown out of the country to India, to the UK, to the US and all these. That flying out is no longer an option for many. And the private hospitals, which are a little bit prepared, have now decided to make a killing out of this pandemic. So nobody had heard of such bills as 100 million for a 2-week hospitalization process. On average, people spend from their income, on average, an average wealthy Ugandan, let's say salaried, earns about $2,000, $1,500. And so there is a crisis actually in the wealthy population. But on the other side, there is this that they can move freely, they can have permits to move around, they can get permits from the district resident district commissioners, as if when you have a permit, the virus cannot get you. So what happens is that then the rich have that leeway. The poor, what does it look like? Lockdown, minimal livelihood options, people who used to have, you know, daily income hand to mouth are at the verge of starving and so on. And now what has happened also is that the government put in place something called a response for the vulnerable, which was appreciated. But what has happened is that the government spent three weeks into the lockdown compiling lists of the vulnerable. And another fourth week now, they've started releasing money to individual funds of people. Now, somebody asked, how come that government can't see the vulnerable? It can take 4 weeks to actually get the vulnerable. And yet, on the other hand, they are beaten on the streets. Those vulnerables are there, they are struggling, they are beaten on the streets. Some people cannot access healthcare, general healthcare, because they can't find transport, because public transport is locked down. If they get like a motorcycle to go to get hospital, some of them have been shot down, as in gunshot. And that brings in the idea that actually it sort of shows that there is more investment in control and militarism than in actually controlling the actual or facilitating the population to deal with the pandemic. So we find that there is more investment in policing. And this policing is actually directed at the poor. Policing, ensuring that people follow the standard operating procedures. And somehow then you kind of see that there is a close connection between neoliberalism and rising militarism. COVID-19 has legitimized militarism because somehow you say, okay, yeah, the pandemic has to be controlled. But that close connection is something to watch, that actually neoliberalism is able to recreate itself. So on the market orthodoxy, we now also have a legitimation of militarism as a legitimate response to a global health challenge. So in a way, what are we saying? We are actually saying that, yes, it's not business as usual, but we didn't know it was this bad. That actually, in the last week, the government released money to buy more vehicles for members of parliament, about 200 million for each. 200 million is about $60,000 for each member of parliament. There are about 528 members of parliament plus a few other ex-official members. So the conversation is around the fact that actually this thing of we can't buy vaccine, we don't have money, and so is a matter of saying that we have chosen not to procure the vaccine. So that amount of money that has gone just in that instance, there are monies that have been used to buy vehicles, double cabin, they call them. And somebody asked, what is the double cabin got to do with controlling COVID-19? Why not invest in testing, vaccination, affordable hospitalization, and so on? So in a way, that nest has shown that there is much more than we had anticipated in there. So what needs to be done? I think one of the ways in which we can deal with some of these things is re-tabling some of the debates around neoliberal orthodoxy and ensuring that especially the Global South can take this seriously. People on the African continent can take this seriously and say, actually, states can and should be able to take on the challenge of dealing with these and other challenges to come. I'll stop here for now and come in later maybe. Thank you very much.
Josephine, thank you so much for those remarks, and building on Sarika's remarks, but also introducing this idea not just of policing, but of militarism and the policing of the poor, and then this terrible bind that we're in between state power and the power of capital. So we have two more speakers tonight. Let me introduce first, not on the programme, but Professor Heaven Crawley. We're delighted that you're able to speak. It looks like I think one of our speakers isn't able to make it. So Professor Crawley will speak first briefly on behalf of the MyDEC Hub, which I should have given the full name for these hubs. We use their acronyms all the time, but the MyDEC Hub is the GCRF South-South Migration, Inequality and Development Hub. Professor Crawley is Professor of International Migration at the Centre for Trust, Peace and Social Relations in Coventry, and has more than 25 years of experience of undertaking research on international migration in a wide range of institutional settings, for the government, for the Home Office at one point, in the voluntary sector, and national and international organisations, and in academia. So Professor Crawley, over to you.
Thanks very much, Kirsten, and thank you for organising this event for all the reasons that you explained at the beginning. It's very important that at a time when our kind of existence is under threat, that we really demonstrate how effective we've been at really identifying some of the key challenges that we're trying to address. So I really appreciate this opportunity, and I will keep my comments brief to allow time for others to contribute and also to have discussion. But just by way of introduction, really, the reason we're called MIDEC and not that great big long-winded title that we officially have is that MIDEC stands for Migration for Development and Equality, because we believe that migration has the potential to really contribute to development and to reduce inequalities. But of course, that relationship between migration and inequalities has often been ignored, with a focus really on the interests of often the global north in managing, maintaining, and controlling and excluding migrants from some of the processes which they might be able to otherwise contribute to. And unfortunately, but not surprisingly, what we've seen with COVID-19 is a kind of exacerbation of some of those trends, a reinforcement of the ways in which migration is conceptualized and the way in which migrants of various categories are treated. So a quote from Antonio Guterres in 2020, you know, when people were talking about COVID potentially being the great equalizer, because, you know, everybody potentially can get COVID. He said, COVID-19 has been likened to an X-ray, revealing fractures in the fragile skeleton of the societies we have built. It's exposing fallacies and falsehoods everywhere, the lie that free markets can deliver healthcare for all, the fiction that unpaid care work is not work, the delusion that we live in a post-racist world, the myth that we are all in the same boat, because while we're all floating on the same sea, it's clear that some are in super yachts whilst others are clinging to drifting debris. And I think that harks back very much to the point that Josephine was making about the kind of neoliberal construction of the societies we live in. And then, of course, the way in which COVID has served to sort of interact with that in various ways and exacerbate what we're seeing. So within MIDEC, in terms of our examination of the relationship between migration and equality, including gender, age, income, and of course, race, we find very much that that there is an exacerbation of the existing inequalities associated with migration. So for example, in the context of refugee protection, we see very much that states are using COVID as an excuse to double down on border closures, to try and further isolate and marginalize refugees from the protection to which they're entitled. We see, of course, refugees often living in very marginalized and poor conditions, which makes coping with the consequences of COVID, not least in terms of livelihood, very challenging. And we're also seeing countries sort of dipping into their migration policy toolbox, if you like, in order to be able to demonstrate their robustness of their response to COVID. So they use migration as a way of demonstrating that they are in control of the pandemic. And as is often the case with migration, it becomes deeply politicized, deeply symbolic, and a way of positioning individuals within and outside or perceived to be other in a particular way in terms of the narratives. And we see that very clearly in terms of the way in which migrants are being treated in some of the countries in which we're working. Now, Faisal will, of course, talk about the situation in South Africa, where this is particularly clear, but we're seeing it elsewhere too. So, for example, in Malaysia, whilst Bangladeshi and other migrant workers from Nepal are largely responsible for the production of plastic gloves that we are all using in huge quantities during this pandemic, the workers who are responsible for producing those gloves are actually being treated incredibly badly, with further exacerbation of poor working conditions, in some case, deportations and removals, because the Malaysian government has really sort of pulled on this as a way of demonstrating, again, its particular political agenda. In Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, we're seeing some of the ripple effects that others were referring to earlier. So, you know, for example, we have large-scale child migration from Burkina Faso to Cote d'Ivoire for the cocoa plantations, so that we can all eat chocolate. And one of the consequences is that people's incomes have gone down, there's greater child migration, and people are being taken out of school in order to be able to increase the household income and take advantage of some of those opportunities. So where progress was being made in terms of educational consequences or outcomes for children, those are now being undermined. And then in a context like Haiti, Brazil, we're seeing a rapid, and in Nepal too, actually, a rapid downturn in remittances, the amount of money that's being sent back. Because of course, if you are a migrant that's traveled for work in order to be able to, you know, send money back to your family in the country of origin, and then you're no longer able to work because of COVID, or because you're being excluded and other sections of the population are being privileged, then those sorts of ripple effects are not necessarily things that people would associate with migration, but they're ultimately tied back into the way in which migration is conceptualized and represented in this deeply political context, because the pandemic is, of course, a health issue, but it's way more than that. I mean, it has, for all the reasons that others have explained, you know, really exacerbated, as I've said earlier, some of the issues that we're seeing in access to health. We're talking about huge differential access to healthcare treatment, but also all those ripple effects that come out from that in terms of work, in terms of gender-based violence, in terms of access to opportunities such as education. So I'll stop there, because I think Faisal can give you so much more concrete examples. But I would say overall, unfortunately, the picture is not very positive. It's not positive at all. But the reason for that is largely because of the way in which migration was already being framed in those countries. So it's sort of deepening the inequalities associated with migration, as opposed to necessarily creating anything particularly new or different. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Heaven. And I hear you, having moved to a country in which borders have been reinscribed in the most violent manner. Let's move now to our final speaker of the night. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Faisal Garba, who's also working on the MyDeck Hub. Dr. Garba teaches sociology at the University of Cape Town and is the co-convener of the university's Global Studies Programme. His areas of expertise are migration, social change and culture, social movements and sociology of work, globalisation and inequality, and historical sociology. Dr. Garba, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks for the invitation. Heaven has really given a good scaffolding for what I'm going to talk about. I'll largely focus on the case of South Africa and occasionally touch on some other parts of the African continent. So to the first question, really, to what extent is COVID business as usual, or, you know, in what ways is COVID exacerbating inequalities and privileging those in power? My response is that, you know, yes, COVID has exacerbated inequality and deepened power imbalances in very profound ways. So for example, COVID has widened the gap between settled and mobile populations through the instrumentalization of citizenship. And this has very serious gender implication. So in South Africa, what we've realized is that the burden of social reproduction has increasingly fallen on women, migrant women, you know, who have to take care of households as a result of retrenchments of their partners, or regularly single-headed households, you know, where women have to keep doing carry out these functions. And now with the reality of lockdowns in South Africa, over the past 1 month, we've been having a seesaw really between partial and total lockdowns. And you have migrant women who would have a job this week, but the next week they're out of job, you know, because of the precarious nature of their jobs. But the responsibility of taking care of the household is in no way mitigated. And this is because the state that has adopted a migrant blind policy in dealing with COVID. At the height of COVID, the state introduced a grant to support families and businesses, small businesses that have suffered under the weight of COVID. Now, one of the requirements is that one has to have citizenship or permits. Now, this was a time where many or all the refugee reception centers that grant permit to refugees were closed. So effectively, refugees were shut out of this very critical need for food and other basic necessities that the state was providing. Now, linked to that is what I call a miasmic kind of deviance, really, where people adopt a policy of mobilizing communities along the lines of anti-foreigner sentiments. So, you know, there were WhatsApp messages doing the round that we have to rebuild. We have to rebuild by taking back our country. So, in a sense, the inability of the state, which is operating under this, you know, myth of trickle-down economics, to meet the basic needs of the populace, is now shifted towards the migrants. It is the migrants that makes it impossible for the state to meet the basic needs of the populace. Linked to that is a setting, deepening of a divide between locals and migrants around migrants as hosts for diseases. That's a long trope in South Africa. that migration is the cause of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And now the idea is that because of the porous borders around Zimbabwe, migrants come in with COVID. And state officials amplify this message. And in a sense, there is this false unity which is created, you know, around, you know, we, the citizens, you know, have to make sure that we protect our country, our country's health against people who will come in with diseases. So in a sense, what this has done is to deepen pre-existing divides and access to resources. Migrants cannot access state support, but also certain business opportunities now are closed, you know, for people who do not have citizenship. And in a sense, what you have is this alliance, you know, between really demagogic forces in the state, you know, trying to mobilize the sentiments of ordinary people who, like many everyday migrants, you know, have been struggling under COVID. So how, or has COVID opened up cracks or exposed weaknesses in the systems of power, which can be exploited for transformative purposes? I think so, to a certain extent. What COVID has proven really is the unsustainability of this differentiation of rights based on citizenship. The fact that COVID respects no borders, the fact that this is not something that you can clearly identify with a group of people shows that the path that we have taken in Africa, for example, the European Union has been trying to create internal borders here by imposing basically Fortress Europe on African countries, insisting that as conditionality for loans or grants, that African states basically, you know, have very restrictive policies, you know, on migration. Now, COVID is really showing the futility of this. The fact that this continent is really a confluence of mobility. And any idea of exclusion, whether it's an access to vaccines, to say, okay, only certain people will be vaccinated, is really creating the conditions for further spread of the pandemic. So what needs to be done to achieve transformation? I'm going to try and because I think I have about 2 minutes, I'm going to try to tackle this with the final question, which is what are some of the most innovative transformative responses to COVID that one has experienced? I think a number of things really. The first is there is the need to move away from the politics of exclusion, which has really characterized state formation in Africa, which is really a colonial yoke, to one where, you know, the idea of an open political community where mobile conception of livelihood is taken seriously. Many countries in Southern Africa, for example, are linked by migrant labor in terms of, you know, people's ability to feed themselves. Okay. And if policy takes on board this, then it means that we have to socialize access to resources, and therefore access to healthcare should be based on residency and not ideas about origins. Now, how can that be achieved? I think in two ways, really, or two ways that I can think of immediately. The first is the need to fuse struggles between migrants and locals. So in South Africa, there's a huge deficit of housing. There's a huge deficit of access to primary healthcare. Now, how does one link that to the reality of excluding migrants in accessing resources? Basically, it's about seeing how structures of power exclude the vulnerable, irrespective of where they come from. And here we are seeing movements that have emerged. You know, there's a movement called Abaklali Basemanjondolo, which is a movement of shack dwellers in KwaZulu-Natal, which has skillfully tried to mobilize locals and migrants around very concrete goals, you know, that could change the character of society using a different direction of political economy. And finally, some innovative initiatives that I have seen, really two that I have been involved in. You know, we are currently in the process of working with a group of migrants in the city of Port Elizabeth, which is in the Eastern Cape of South Africa, as part of MIDEC, to set up migrant solidarity initiatives, you know, that would enable migrants to work with local communities in order to put on the agenda very concrete issues, you know, around access to resources, access to healthcare, but also things around violence and xenophobia as a way of taking advantage of this very moment. And the final example that I want to cite is in relation to our project in West Africa. So we have a Ghana-China corridor, and I work on a work package on migrant solidarity and political mobilization. And what we realized after working with our colleagues in Ghana is that there's absolutely no single civil society organization that is either devoted to the everyday experience of migrants or that incorporates migrants in its advocacy, on its advocacy platforms. And so we're working with activists to put together some form of a vehicle, an entity, you know, that brings together migrants, thematizes their issues, and integrate them into demands that people are making to structurally change the economy and hopefully have a different society as a way of overcoming COVID. So I hope I haven't done too badly with time. I will stop here in the hope that this is really an initial input. What should matter most is the conversation. Thank you very much.
Dr. Kerber, thank you very, very much for a fascinating remarks and for bringing attention to securitization of citizenship, the importance of mobility to life for livelihood. So much has come out of these comments so far. I would encourage everybody who is here, if they would like to ask a question, to type it into the chat. We are observing a hierarchy tonight, and we have freed up the principal investigators of the three hubs, all of whom are here with us tonight to speak and to unmute themselves. But because it's a big group, I'm delighted to see it's such a big group. I will read out questions from others. So please do put your questions into the chat. And just before we start, I know there are a couple of questions already. I did want to make a point that occurs to me from having listened to all of these speakers, that these three hubs contain extraordinary expertise on inequality. And there's been a rush of people to the field in response to COVID, but these hubs and the people on them have been working on these issues for decades. And it's only by understanding inequality, and particularly by looking at discriminatory structures based on gender and race, and the minoritization and the demonization of particular groups, that you can understand how this pandemic is playing out. Because it's crazy, because all of us can see that global decent healthcare is what's going to be needed, and universal vaccination to get us out of this. And yet we are seeing vaccine apartheid and we're seeing nationalism. So you have to understand prior structures of social inequality to understand how COVID is playing out. And to anybody who's involved in funding bodies, what we don't need is we don't need new projects by new teams that have been written in the last 6 months. What we need is the people who already have the expertise on these issues to continue to work on the projects, to really be able to understand how to get through and on from COVID. Let me turn now to the questions that have been asked so far tonight in the chat, which I'm scrolling through quite a lot here to get back to the first question that I saw, which is from Kim Jurgensen from South Africa, who said, I'd be interested to hear more about why Sarika is uncomfortable with the term empowering women. So Sarika, if we can turn back to you to answer that question, and you may also, if you want to, by all means, build on any of the comments that other speakers have made, just to take a minute or two in response to that question and any other points you want to raise now.
Yeah, thanks, Kirsten. Yes, I knew I was going to get a question on why I said I was uncomfortable with the term empowerment. So I think for me, empowerment implies a formal rather than substantive power. And this has remained a space where mainly dominant classes are seeking to grant power to poor women, but within a boundary. So they limit it around low-level skills, trainings, and low-level earnings, and so on. And I think over decades, one of the distressing things for someone like me who lives in a third world country is that there's very little reflexivity on why these spaces are unable to foster solidarity for the poor and poor women to seize power through their own struggles, you know? And I think that's very important because a lot of the emphasis on participation and empowerment is how to integrate the poor into existing governance institutions and production systems. It doesn't normally, and rarely does it, allow us to actually ask what the change should be or could be. And are we generous enough to cede space to the poor women to then decide for themselves? And I think this goes to the issue of dignity that I did speak about initially when I talked to it. And I think it's interesting that I was asked about empowerment. I mean, the point is that the experiences of COVID-19 and the entrenched inequalities and the exacerbation has not happened simply because COVID happened. It is decades of austerity and its impact on poor. And to someone who works in the public health / global health field, I really feel that decisions that are taken very far away from the lives of the poor have so much power to damage the poor communities across the world, and that women are then left to deal with this mess and somehow keep trying constantly repairing the mess that is inflicted on them by the others. And this concept of all women are nurturers and somehow they're going to, you know, see us through this. And it's very debilitating, A, as a woman, but I think for poor women, I guess they always ask themselves, why us, why me, why do we have to keep doing this? And I think nobody is asking these questions any longer. So that is one thing. And I think essentially, it doesn't matter which field you're in. I feel that, particularly because I'm engaged in global health and public health, I don't think we can, as researchers and activists or civil society organizations looking for right to health, et cetera, and so on, can disengage from practices of austerity. And the consistent disengagement of the state, I think one of the earlier speakers talked about the importance of state in people's lives. But it is astonishing that while they disengage themselves from actually the poor people get their rights, or, you know, there's a whole series of things that have happened over the last 40 years across the world that they retain power over their lives by not doing much for them and just doing like cherry picking or just, you know, on the top kind of social security schemes. And I think one of the things, particularly I think for me, one of the reflections in the last year has been is that as researchers, I think we have to be very conscious that we have to uphold the right to health and work, because this seems to have been lost in practices of austerity, in whatever form, whichever government has done it, in whatever way. So I think I will stop there and take any other questions later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have another question that's specific to Uganda. So I'd like to turn back now to Josephine. So Josephine, you may want to respond to some of what the other speakers have said, but also Grace Akello, who is a medical anthropologist based in Uganda, has noted that in Uganda, poor market women have continued to operate even during lockdown. And it appears that the lower middle class are more affected by COVID-19, and has asked if you'd examined experiences within across the spectrum to poverty. So Josephine, perhaps you could take that question on and make any other comments you wanted to make in a minute or two.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. I think it's more of a comment that the low income people have really taken the brunt, and I think Sureka has put it very well that women are really left behind, you know, to deal with the mess. The mess of inequality, the mess of market orthodoxy, the mess of anti-democratic states, all this mess is coming up and is showing in this instance of the pandemic. And I think just as I think Faizo has mentioned, what this has helped us to do is to realize how much more we need to do. For instance, the issue about creating an open political community, but also an open conversation around the fact that actually nobody is safe until everybody is safe. So even the wealthy have now realized that, you know, I think it's important to actually invest in public health care, because this thinking that you can always go to outside the country, that you can always go to private hospitals, has certainly backfired. And somehow this should be the time for a conversation to take these as political questions. So thank you, Akello. I'll stop there for now.
Thanks very much, Josephine. Let me ask Faisal if you wanted to come back. There's a quick message in the chat from Grace Akello to say if you'd like to address anti-immigrant sentiments, need to focus beyond encouraging immigrants to demand their access to quality healthcare. I'm going to, Evelyn, I'm sorry, I'm going to be slightly chaotic here and request that we might be able to unmute speakers, questioners sometimes, partly because I think people don't always know how the question is going to come out until they say it. And so it's a bit tricky to type it into the chat. But I wondered whether Grace might just want to say a little bit more about that to help Faisal answer the question. So Evelyn, thanks for that, Evelyn. Evelyn can unmute people. So Evelyn, if you could just unmute Grace Akello, that would be great. And I'll ask Grace just to say a little bit more about that question before we go to Faisal to answer it and make any other comments he has.
Thank you, Kirsten, for giving me this chance to talk about immigrants, anti-migrant sentiments, and also how people try to comprehend or understand these extreme experiences. In my view, I think there are various ways. Behavior is really fluid. If you can't manage a stimuli, if you can't deal with everyday experiences which are extreme, there is a tendency to blame or to look for somebody to displace your experiences. And this is pretty much what I see here. We did a study on pandemic preparedness and response in the border between Uganda and Congo. And what I saw was very similar to Professor Gaba's, whereby many local residents at these borders blame Congolese for everything. They blame them for flooding of rivers. They blame them for bringing in COVID. They blame them for poor health services in Uganda. They blame them for accessing more vaccines at the health centers compared to Ugandans and so on. So these anti-migrant sentiments, I think somebody needs to scrutinize what is happening here. Is it behavior which can be addressed by providing services? Is it behavior which needs more psychological and more or less addressing some of these social, like deeply embedded social issues? You know, this is what I wanted to Professor Gaba to explain or to discuss.
Thank you very much, Grace. Thank you. Over to you, Faisal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Grace. I think that's an important question. So for some time now, actually, I have been, initially I was alone, but now there's some people who are joining me in making a certain argument that in South Africa, we see this outburst of xenophobic attacks, you know, targeted at migrants from other parts of the continent, but also from Bangladesh and India. And somehow the idea is that, you know, working class or poor South Africans, you know, have this deep-seated hatred towards non-South Africans. Now, I conducted a number of studies in different townships. These are the most economically underprivileged parts of South Africa, you know, giving apartheid legacy. What I realized is that the bulk of everyday interaction between migrants and locals is actually the opposite of xenophobia. It's about a great deal of solidarity, protection, but also about struggling for employment or at times fixing prices on the sidewalks of streets. In a certain township in Johannesburg, there is a regular standing committee, mainly formed by women, to defend foreigners against attacks. Now, where are these attacks coming from? So we realized a correlation between electoral cycles and these attacks. And then what we did was to take time to go through manifestos, but also campaign promises of councillors at the local level. So what we saw was that local councillors were basically stoking these flames by promising to take foreign-owned shops and hand them over to local businesses. So local businesses and local councillors and national politicians across ideological divide, you know, apart from some few exceptions, you know, mobilize people on the basis of this. And often when these mobilizations happen at the local level, it is the ordinary people that defend locals. So therefore, what I was trying to say in terms of access to healthcare is basically one point to say, often these mobilizations, the counter to xenophobia has to begin from the set of issues or the issue which is particularly topical. And at the moment, it is the question of vaccine, it is the question of access to health. And so the campaign is around, as the professor who spoke before me said, nobody is safe if one of us is unsafe, right? And then working on this conviviality, this solidarity that exists between locals and migrants in the communities to say, okay, what different politics can come out of that? And we in the academy, how do we support that, you know, through action research, through committed scholarship that highlights these things as we also focus on the xenophobia as a way of producing a different program, you know, for a different form of society. So I agree with the point that Grace makes. It's not really about focusing just on healthcare, but you see, in order to have a program, you need to begin from somewhere. And often strategically, you have to begin from what is topical at the moment. Then you look at the other set of factors. So thank you very much for the question.
Thank you very much for that, Faisal, and for underlining, as other speakers have also, the importance of respecting the political agency of people, even people who are suffering the most incredible inequalities, who often get painted as victims, but actually have an enormous capacity to be able to see, understand, and propose solutions to the struggles that they are engaged in and are actively stopped from doing so. So it's wonderful to see these three hubs are all engaging in that kind of research and practice. I was to call now on Professor Sally Theobald, who is the principal investigator of the Arise Hub. Sally wanted to speak, I think, a little about what we can do across the hubs. But Sally, over to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you so much to all the speakers. It's been brilliant and it's been so refreshing to come together as hubs and share experience. We've been coming together to navigate the politics of the aid cuts, and it's brilliant to come together on the substance, on the issues. And we've heard from all the speakers about how COVID is revealing and emphasizing inequities, a window into society, a mirror, an X-ray, enhancing precarity, as Faisal had said. And the ways in which COVID-19 play out just, to me, emphasize the importance of this solidarity, emphasize the importance of coming together to contest cuts to the UK aid budget. We need solidarity now more than ever. And just a couple of quick reflections from the Arise Hub. So many of the national responses to COVID-19 have been inappropriate, impractical for those living in informal settlements. So focusing on washing hands where there's no sanitation, social distancing, the challenges of that, the lockdowns and what that means for livelihoods, for hunger. And like Josephine highlighted, we've also seen across Arise Hub contexts a rise in violent policing and militarism. But we've also, as I think Faisal has said, seen social movements and community-based groups that have mobilized local responses and challenged the politics of exclusion. And just to give a couple of very brief examples. So with the Arise Hub, we've been working to link with community health volunteers, a critical interface between health systems and people living and working in informal settlements. So for example, LVCT Health in Kenya have been working on COVID-19 prevention messages with over 12,000 community health volunteers, linking that to also respond to sexual and gender-based violence, having specific systems for support for adolescent girls and young women with COVID-19 messaging. In Sierra Leone, colleagues in FEDERP, SLRC and others have been working to ensure the inclusion of informal urban settlements and dwellers in pandemic responses, innovating with apps in order to report inequities. And also in India and Bangladesh and across, feeding into vaccine responses and building on that embedded knowledge of inequities to try to push for vaccine inequity in this challenging world of inequities that you outlined, Kirsten. The other thing that we've been doing is updating our safeguarding responses, because we've seen this rise in sexual and gender-based violence in all contexts, thinking about how do we respond to that when services are stretched and challenged? How do we respond to safeguarding concerns in an online world? Because we've had to innovate with putting some of our methods online. So we're thinking a lot about that too. And I wondered if that is an area in which we can have further conversation, as well as around the politics of inclusion and contestation and solidarity. So I just wanted to express my thanks to come together at how refreshing it's been, and that I hope we can continue to do this and how important it is. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sally. I'm sure you're right that there's a lot that can be done around research methods, what it means to do research post-COVID, the ways in which researchers, academics, activists can be closed out even more than they were being closed out prior to the event of COVID, shut out of policy spaces because now you have to be invited to a Zoom meeting. You can't just hang around and hope you might make it into a room, hope you might get the ear of somebody who has some influence. So I'm sure there's a lot to be done. I wanted now to ask Professor Christine Chinkin, who's the principal investigator of the Gender, Justice and Security Hub, to make some comments. Christine, over to you.
Thanks, Kirsten. And really what I wanted to do was first say what fantastic speakers, and doesn't that illustrate just what the hubs are supposed to be about? And then to echo what Sally said about solidarity. I remember, Sally, when we all went to that very first meeting of the hubs and they all sounded so disparate, you sort of thought, what on earth have all these 12 hubs got in common with each other? And one of the things that COVID has done has actually shown just how much there is in common in exposing the inequalities, exposing the ways in which the current structures themselves have created the intractable challenges that the hubs were set up to address. And absolutely the need to engage solidarity on the substance as well as just fighting the political system that we've all been doing. I wanted to say a couple of things that occurred to me out of the speakers that relate particularly to the Gender, Justice and Security Hub. One of the challenges that we were addressing is how to make the Women, Peace and Security agenda a real agenda, how it could actually be implemented rather than just be words from the Security Council. And I think two things have come out really strongly. One of the pillars of WPS is participation. And what we see so much, I think, is the two sides. On the one hand, the international community's response is, oh, we'll bring a few women in and then we've done tick the box of participation and that's all we need. And as was so clearly said by the first speaker, this is not empowerment. This is merely bringing in two structures that already exist. But when women, other excluded peoples do try to speak for themselves, as you just said, Kirsten, they're too often just shut down. And yet at the same time, as we have this agenda of participation, it still isn't actually carried out anyway. So we lose on both. Who said a double or a triple whammy? You know, we lose on both fronts. We lose on being told, yes, participation is important, but you must participate on our terms, but then we don't even let you do that anyway. And one of the striking things about the pandemic is how many, and certainly I think this is true in our country, of the national decision-making bodies around COVID are not inclusive and fail to ensure the diversity of views that are needed to address the particular issues that are being raised up by multiple diverse peoples within the country. And the second is the redefinition of security itself. Josephine was talking about how security, how a smokescreen of COVID has allowed growing militarization in terms of security, growing policing, growing control in different ways. And what we are seeing is security is much, much wider than how it has been traditionally understood in the Women, Peace and Security agenda, certainly, but within communities more generally. And I can't resist just throwing in what my own country is doing at the moment in terms of security, increasing its nuclear arsenal. Well, that's really going to kill COVID, isn't it? And again, who emphasizes its choices, political choices. And these are just what are so important. But thank you so much, Kirsten and the speakers for arranging this.
Thank you very much for that, Christine. We have just a few minutes left. I'm under strict instructions to finish on time, but we do have time if anybody would like, either any of our speakers or anybody in the audience would like to make a brief statement or ask another question.
Well, can I
please do. I was going to say, I don't think other people can unmute themselves, so you have to indicate to us, but the speakers can all jump in, so please do.
Okay, no, thank you. Thank you very much. The final point I want to make really is around the interconnections of the issues that we're looking at. So yes, MIDEC, you know, migration, inequality and development. But key to all this is really global inequality. You see, as it manifests itself in racialized, gendered ways and in other kind of markers of social difference. And so when we speak about solidarity, and I think for me, this is really crucial here, it's also about how it manifests itself, you know, across issues, but across nations, to realize that these things do not just happen at the local level, they are mediated by processes that happen beyond the local level, exacerbated at the local level. And so one of the initiatives that I think is important, but I forgot to mention, is an attempt by a collective of scholars really working under something called Postcolonialism Today, which was trying to recover lessons in social policy in the immediate aftermath of colonialism in Africa and Asia. So social policies around kind of expanding the realm of the public sphere, access to basic necessities as the main kind of reason for the state existing as a state. And a way to realize that COVID, yes, is an epidemiological pandemic, but really it is the social pandemic that pre-existed that deepens the implications of COVID. So that's all I want to say. And to finally say thank you very much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Faisal. Anybody else want to make any last points? Josephine.
Yeah, I just wanted to end with something around keeping hope alive and how shall we emerge out of this brutalization effect of COVID-19. And also to say that many of the communities, many of the institutions are behaving as if COVID is the only thing that is happening, the only ailment, the only situation, and it's as if everything else has actually come to a standstill. And the answer is actually no. All the other ailments, people's morbidities are going up, they cannot access healthcare, all the inequalities and all the sort of unequal kind of relations in land are still continuing. Evictions are continuing. People are losing land. All these things are actually still happening. How shall we respond? How shall we emerge out of this? Shall we emerge stronger to deal with these and other effects that have been uncovered by this pandemic? That's what I wanted to put on the table.
Thank you very much. Heaven, I think you wanted to make a final point.
Just very briefly, and echoing what Joe's been said, I mean, our job as the hubs, particularly in these first few years of our work, has really been to, you know, to document, to highlight and draw attention to what's going on. And of course, in the context of COVID, we've had to do that in quite different ways. But we've certainly been doing that regardless of what's been going on. And I think the key now, as Josephine says, is to find, just to envisage, envision something different, and how we bring to bear all this knowledge and this this information in a way that builds solidarity and provides different access points than previously. Because I think a lot of us, you know, historically in the area of migration, we've been battling hard to change the political narratives. And we know right now that that's something of a lost cause, the UK being a very good example of that, but many, many others too. And I think, you know, it's really about building change from the bottom up. I think relying upon political leaders at this point, when we know what their agenda is politically and in terms of the, you know, neoliberalism more generally, they are not going to change things from the top down. And what we really need to do is to, as Faisal and others have said, build these networks of solidarity to try and tackle what's going on, but not specifically through the lens of COVID, and other than as an entry point, because it is about much wider global inequalities, you know, horizontal and vertical inequalities of various kinds. And I think that's what our hubs are very good at demonstrating. And I think this event, as others have said, is really good at highlighting the commonalities between our work. And the fact that, you know, for a long time, nobody, and still nobody really talks about inequality. I mean, but we've talked about nothing else on this call. And I think that a lot of our work is oriented towards inequality. And I think, you know, much more focus on that is really going to start to create solidarity between people who are disenfranchised in different ways, but nonetheless affected. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Heaven. And Sarika, you wanted to make the final point.
Yes, Kirsten, thanks. So I really liked Dr. Garber saying that this is a social pandemic and that it is not. And I think, and that sort of allows for us to build solidarities. I think solidarities are being built even as we go through the thing, as we're going through the COVID. It's just that we need to be careful not to replicate the existing power structures through solidarities. I think we need, because if we don't change that, then what comes at the end will still look the same. And so I feel like that's an important thing. So I just wanted to say thank you for your patience and letting me talk. And I enjoyed the meeting. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Sarika. And thank you to our audience tonight. But thank you in particular to all of the speakers. It's been a real privilege to hear from you and to spend time with you. I hope we can continue to work together. Just in closing, can I encourage you to follow the Twitter pages of the three hubs, which I hope has already been put into the chat, but perhaps could be pasted in again. And the recording of the event tonight will be advertised through our Twitter pages of those hubs. I also implore you to advocate through your networks for the continued funding of this kind of research, participatory work that is part of a broader struggle against inequality and injustice that keeps in sight the violence and the discrimination that was already taking place and that brings together diverse perspectives to get new answers, to change the narrative, to lead, we would hope, to genuine change. There are more events in the convention this week. There will be another event on in an hour and a half. At 12 o'clock midday British Standard Time, which is on gendered dynamics of international labour migration. You are most welcome to attend that. I hope to see you there. But thank you again, particularly to the speakers, but thank you to everybody who attended tonight.